This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
French President Emmanuel Macron said there had been spectacular results. We are convinced that victory is possible in the Sahel and that this is decisive for stability in Africa and Europe, he said.
That's Nicolas Pinault summarizing French President Emmanuel Macron's summary of the last 6 months regarding the anti-jihadist mission in the Sahel region. Details coming up also. In Ethiopia's Oromia region, the number of deaths because of protests has reached at least 50. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The number of dead in Ethiopia's Oromia region following the fatal shooting of popular singer Hachalu Hundessa has reached at least 50, according to the latest Reuters report. The dead include protesters and members of the security forces. Prominent Oromo opposition leader Bakala Garba and media mogul Jawar Mohammed were also arrested when, according to Reuters, Jawar's bodyguards refused to disarm during a standoff with police. Musician Hachalu, whose funeral will be held tomorrow, provided a soundtrack to a generation of young protesters. 3 years of bloody street demonstrations forced the unprecedented resignation of the previous prime minister and the appointment of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in 2018. Meanwhile, an Ethiopian opposition leader has expressed concern about Ethiopian security forces' treatment of opposition supporters and pro-democracy groups. Marara Gudina, chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress, says the opposition wants to have a say in the way security forces are conducting themselves.
I'm calling you because of recent developments in Ethiopia after a prominent artist has been reported killed. What do you know so far? What's happening in the country in terms of human rights situation in Ethiopia right now?
Well, there are reports of protests in Addis Ababa and other cities and towns following the killing of very popular Oromo singer Hakalau Hundessa. And so it's absolutely key that the Ethiopian authorities respond to this by acting urgently to reduce tensions and to ensure that security forces do not make what could be a combustible situation worse. The government needs to order security forces not to use excessive force or to carry out arbitrary arrests, including against protesters, as they've often done in the past.
And also referencing to your report, you had an extensive report back in April looking into the conditions of human rights situation right now and the lack of response from the current government, including internet shutdown. If you can give me a background of what this is happening at the heels of the recent report.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in April, we released a report which was investigating both the abuses but also the violence which had happened during 3 days of unrest in the country in October 2019. And what we had seen was that although the government, both regional government in Oromia and the federal government, had initiated investigations into some of the abuses and the violence in Ambo Town and in Dodola Town, both in the Oromia region, which we had looked into, this hadn't resulted in any clear forms of redress and any final outcomes of these investigations. At the same time, as you say, we have raised concerns in early 2020 when the government carried out a prolonged internet and phone shutdown in Western Oromia region. And we raised concerns about the impact this was having on families who couldn't communicate amongst themselves, on health services. This was obviously particularly concerning once the pandemic began to affect Ethiopia. But it was also concerning because this meant that communities and people outside of Western Oromia couldn't get information on what was happening, and notably on the government's counterinsurgency operations there. So then putting that into the current context, it's absolutely key for the government to make sure that as soon as possible, it is providing accurate, timely information to the public on what they're doing to investigate yesterday's killing, but also how they are responding to what could be a very tense situation. So constant, clear, accurate information is going to be key, and transparency is going to be key here.
Abiy Ahmed has been in power for over a year plus. What is the ultimate solution for these kinds of outbursts and violence and protests now that we are seeing protests happening in the capital city? Is there any sustainable solution for the country moving forward?
I mean, obviously, this killing appears to be generating very profound reactions. But I think this is once again a trigger for the expression of underlying grievances. As we saw last year with the October protests and violence that we saw, this was also an expression of anger with a lack of reforms. A lot of promises had been made in the past, some of which have been followed up on, many of which have not been. So I think it really is key for the authorities to make sure that they are creating a space in which grievances can be expressed peacefully, but also making sure that people feel that their grievances are leading to concrete reforms. So I think, you know, as we've said in the past, this is both a question of reforming key institutions. The security forces are one of the places where the government really needs to focus. And we're talking here not only about the federal security forces, but also the regional security forces, making sure that people feel that they have places where they can go and will be listened if they have complaints against government institutions, against security force behavior and actions, but also making sure that different parts of society are having their voices heard. And again, this is going to be absolutely critical around the postponed elections. Once again, making sure that these are not perceived or actually executive decisions in which other parts of society, opposition parties, but broader parts of society don't have a say, is going to be absolutely critical to ensuring that this situation doesn't happen again.
Elections are slotted again past the pandemic. Any concrete date that you've heard from the government that is promising for the elections to take place?
No, I mean, of course, there have been the recent discussions around, you know, months after the public health crisis is over. I think key here is really going to make sure that there is a transparent communication about what is happening. But as I was just saying, really making sure that all parties and all parts of society feel that their voices and their perspectives are heard in these discussions, and that, you know, there will be a space for different groups to also basically have their voices heard in the campaign period, etc. So there are a lot of concerns, and I think the problem is there aren't always many avenues and channels through which these concerns are able to be voiced or heard, and often a lack of evidence that the government is listening when these concerns are being voiced.
Sahel countries and their ally France have vowed to press ahead with a tactical shift in their campaign against an 8-year-old jihadist insurgency, saying the change has notched up substantial gains, although major challenges also remain. Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris.
The one-day summit gathered the presidents of Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania and Niger, as well as France. The heads of state met in the Mauritanian capital, Nouakchott, to review their new strategy at the six-month mark. French President Emmanuel Macron said there had been spectacular results. "We are convinced that victory is possible in the Sahel and that this is decisive for stability in Africa and Europe, he said. Under the change, France deployed an extra 500 troops to its Barkhane anti-jihad force in the Sahel, bringing its complement to 5,100. Since then, the jihadists have continued to carry out attacks almost daily, but they also lost a key leader to a French raid and are fighting internally, according to security forces. Coalition forces have focused on the three border region, a hotspot of jihadism where the frontiers of Burkina, Niger and Mali converge. Areas have been taken back from the terrorist groups and the armies are redeployed, claimed Macron, adding that the tactics have shifted the dynamic. President Mohamed Ould Cheikh Al-Ghazouani of Mauritania was earlier more cautious, saying there had been significant progress, but this wasn't sufficient in the face of the mounting challenges that they have to meet. A violent extremism in all its forms continued to hit several zones and is expanding in a worrying manner, he said. The next summit of the Sahel Allies was set for early 2021. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry has urged the UN Security Council to adopt a resolution on negotiations over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam that would encourage Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan to reach agreement on the massive project within 2 weeks and refrain from taking any unilateral action. The 15 members of the Security Council all expressed support for the African Union facilitating renewed talks, and Addis Ababa wants the UN to stay out of it and let the AU take the lead. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi spoke with Said Sadek, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, about chances for achieving that goal.
Very much unlikely why the United Nations Security Council has not been able to solve many conflicts in the last few years. You can talk about Iraq, you can talk about banning arms to Libya. All the resolutions that were issued were ignored by many of the members of the council. Egypt had felt that this is very important to them, and also Sudan. And I think the aim is to get international diplomatic and media support, but not really on the ground. It will not force the Ethiopians to change their mind, because the Ethiopian decision-making process is tied to many internal problems. Ethiopian society is composed of 80 different ethnic groups, and this is the only way they can unify the society is over the Jordan. Also externalizing the enemy, Egypt is portrayed in Ethiopian media as an enemy. There is an election, presidential election coming in Ethiopia in August. So for all those reasons, it is very difficult for the Ethiopians to compromise. Add to that, the past experience of Ethiopians with United Nations were not very good. They had a border dispute with Eritrea, and they went for arbitration, and that ended the only option for access to the Red Sea, for any sea. And so ever since that time, they have become a landlocked country. And so they feel that any resort to international organization will not serve the purposes and will repeat historical mistakes.
The 15 members of the Security Council all expressed support for the African Union facilitating renewed talks, and Addis Ababa wants the United Nations to stay out of it and let the African Union take the lead. Could the African Union succeed in reaching an acceptable and verifiable agreement?
Regional organizations are generally very weak. Look at the AU, look at the Arab League. So the likelihood that the African Union will succeed in reaching any solution is not really in the horizon. Remember, even when Egypt took the dispute to Washington and they had the American Treasury Department, the World Bank, and it had failed. And most likely the UN Security Council would issue a gray resolution asking the partisans to continue negotiations and try to solve the problem. We think that is not binding, because they are resorting to Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, that talks about resolutions but not binding, no sanctions. Only if there is economic sanctions against Ethiopia, maybe then there will be a change of the Ethiopian position. The best thing for the Ethiopians is to delay any decision regarding the filling of the dam until after the presidential election in August. Then they will have less pressure domestically on delaying or prolonging the filling operation.
Sudanese ambassador to the UN, Omar Sadiq, called for a demonstration of political goodwill and commitment to ironing out the few remaining issues and reaching a final agreement. And on the other hand, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Kerry Craft, said the three countries can reach a balanced and equitable agreement if there is a commitment among all to do so. What do you make of these statements?
Diplomatic statements that need the obliging parties to international law and transboundary rivers regulations. The Nile is an international river, not a national river for the Ethiopians. But up till today, they are treating the whole river as an Ethiopian issue. The real question is drafting a resolution that would be binding. And this is not really feasible in accordance with the situation. And that is the fear. Why? Because now if there is a rhetorical resolution and the Ethiopians unilaterally start filling the dam, the Egyptian government will be under heavy domestic pressure to act militarily. And this is where the security issue and peace would be affected. Egypt has a capacity to attack the dam, but I don't see that any official in Egypt had talking about military action, whereas the Ethiopians officials were talking about defense and preparing for war. You need really international pressure that this issue will develop into a big dispute that can affect East Africa, as if the area needs more conflict. They have enough conflict.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Here is a recap of our top stories. The number of dead in Ethiopia's Oromia region following the fatal shooting of a popular singer has reached at least 50. And Sahel countries, together with their ally France, have vowed to press ahead with their campaign against an 8-year-old jihadist insurgency in the region. Thank you for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Millions of Congolese are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the independence from Belgium. They're also celebrating the fall of one of the most prominent symbols of the colonization and plunder of their country, King Leopold II. Inspired by the U.S. Black Lives Matter movement, protesters in Belgian cities have taken down several statues of the former leader. King Leopold II, who has been called the Butcher of the Congo, oversaw a brutal administration responsible for the death of an estimated 10 million Congolese in a span of 23 years. Professor Adam Hochschild, author of the critically acclaimed book King Leopold's Ghost, tells VOA's Jackson Mfunganye that Leopold, who never stepped foot in Congo, ruled the country like it was his own personal property.
The Belgian government was not interested in colonies because they thought that was an extravagance for a small country with no navy and no merchant marine. But for Leopold, that was not a problem. He thought, well, I'll get my own personal colony. So he hired the explorer Henry Morton Stanley to stake it out for him. And by 1885, he'd gotten first the United States and then all the major nations of the world to recognize the Congo, the same territory roughly as the boundaries of the Democratic Republic of Congo today, as belonging to him personally.
Not the country of Belgium or the kingdom of Belgium, but for him as a king, personally, it was his personal...
It was his personal possession, and he talked about himself as its proprietor. And it was more than 70 times the size of Belgium. It remained in his personal possession for 23 years. And then in 1908, a year before he died, it became the Belgian Congo. But up to that point, it belonged to him personally, and he made an enormous fortune from it during that time, chiefly by developing a forced labor system to gather what was then the territory's most lucrative commodity, which was wild rubber. And basically, his soldiers would go into village after village, would hold the women hostage in order to force the men of each village to go deep into the rainforest for days and eventually weeks out of each month and gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. And you can actually see photographs of these women hostages in chains.
What was happening in the world at the time? What was driving the need for this rubber?
Good question. It really began in 1887 when for the first time they invented the inflatable bicycle tire. And then suddenly there was a big demand for rubber for bicycle tires, and very soon after that for automobiles, which really began in the 1890s. There was also a big market for rubber in industrial uses of all kinds, belts, rubber belts in factories, rubber coatings on the telegraph and telephone wires, which were spreading all over the world.
What are some of the ghosts that are still haunting, Leopold's ghosts that are still haunting the DRC now?
I would say the biggest ghost is this. The whole system of colonialism, under colonialism, government, as experienced by people in Africa, was basically an organized system of plunder. Government departments of every kind essentially existed to speed the theft of raw materials out of the country and get them to Europe. When the Congo became independent, rather suddenly, in 1960, there had been no experience whatever of self-government, you know, even allowing people to have local elections or anything like that. And I think the experience of government as an organized system of plunder continued. For 32 years, the fairly newly independent Congo was ruled by the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who made a personal fortune even greater than that of Leopold's. He had a much more developed economy to plunder, and he also had strong support from the United States. He turned that country almost into a private colony of his own. After his downfall and death in 1997, the country has mainly been run by the Kabila dynasty, father and son, who've also amassed a considerable fortune, and who, even though the younger Kabila is now officially out of power, he has enormous influence behind the scenes. And I think the experience of government as an organized system of plunder has continued. And that's a very difficult heritage to get rid of.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thanks for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
When a more massive
massive star dies, its core collapses from tremendous gravity and forms a black hole. A star with less mass explodes in a supernova and becomes a neutron star. Scientists at the U.S. LIGO and Italy's Virgo collaborations have detected what they describe as an unusual gravitational wave signal. They say the signal was generated by the merger of a 2.6 solar mass object with a 23 solar mass black hole. The reason for the uncertainty of the first object was that it had a mass between the heaviest known neutron star, 2.5 solar masses, and the lightest known black hole, 5 solar masses. The scientists are trying to determine if the object was now the heaviest neutron star or the lightest black hole known to science. Details of the discovery were published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. I'm VOA's